KALW.
Our people have no more fear of anyone, no more fear of anything. We are not afraid to go to jail. We are not afraid to give our very life itself.
To some, Malcolm X was a polarizing figure, but to one Egyptian diplomat, he was a friend.
Malcolm was interested in finding answers to questions that occupied his mind.
The friendship that helped lead to the late leader's spiritual and political transformation. Then we hear how a young basketball player in the 1960s in Berkeley was influenced by the message.
I began to study Malcolm, and his approach was, of course, self-defense.
And we hear from a senior who knows the value of self-reliance. That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Tomorrow would have been the 97th birthday of the man known as Malcolm X. He's most widely associated with his work in Harlem, but the Bay Area mattered to him. He gave speeches in San Francisco, Oakland, and UC Berkeley.
Our people have no more fear of anyone, no more fear of anything. We are not afraid to go to jail. We are not afraid to give our very life itself. And we're not afraid to take the lives of those who try to take our lives. We believe in a fair exchange. We believe in a fair exchange. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a head for a head, and a life for a life. If this is the price of freedom, we won't hesitate to pay the price.
But maybe most importantly, the Bay Area is where he cemented an important friendship with Egyptian diplomat Tahsin Bashir. As KALW's Sunni Khalid tells us, for Bashir, Malcolm X was the rare leader who had more questions than answers.
I lived in Egypt for 3 years when I was the Cairo bureau chief for NPR. I interviewed Tahsin Bashir several times and we became good friends. My last interview with him took place in Cairo in November 2001. In 1956, Tahsin was working at the United Nations and living in Harlem, then the thriving cultural and political capital of Black America. He was speaking to several African American groups, trying to build support for the Egyptian revolution. At one gathering, Tahsin met Malcolm X, then the national representative for the militant Nation of Islam.
And Malcolm came, introduced himself, and then he contacted me to come and to talk about Egypt, the Suez Canal, and the attack on Egypt.
The speech was to be given at the Nation of Islam's Temple No. 7 in Harlem, where Malcolm was minister.
And he asked me, how many people you want to attend? I said, I don't care. I mean, it depends on your group. He said, no, I can get you 5,000, 6,000. And I went to the mosque. And I started giving my speech, very heart-rendering speech. And the people will answer or interrupt by saying, that's right, that's right, that's right, that's right.
The two men began to meet privately at Tahsin's nearby apartment.
And he never tells me beforehand when he's coming. All I get is two dark fellows knocking on my door and standing by the door in diagonally. And they say, are you here? I said, yes. And said, well, Brother Malcolm wants to see you. I said, fine. When does he want to come? And usually the answer right now, he's downstairs with other guards in the car. He comes out, but everybody leaves us and we talk and then he leaves.
Tahsin and Malcolm became friends. Initially, their discussions were about Malcolm telling him about the Nation of Islam. The movement was both respected and feared for its advocacy of Black nationalism and its denunciation of, quote, blonde-haired, blue-eyed devils, unquote.
He also taught me a lot about the movement of Elijah Muhammad. And of course, a lot of it was news to me, the creation of a different Islam. It has some aspects remotely related to Islam. But in essence, it was a Black movement against the whites.
Soon, their discussions began to deal with the differences between traditional Islam and the version preached by Elijah Muhammad, the self-styled messenger of the Nation of Islam.
And he was struggling with the question that a lot of what Elijah had taught is not the traditional Sunni Islam, but some version that claims to be Islamic.
Tahsin said that Malcolm privately started questioning the direction of the Nation of Islam several years before he left the movement.
But Malcolm was interested in finding answers to questions that occupied his mind.
In 1961, Tahsin moved to San Francisco, where he served as Consul General of the Egyptian Consulate. Meanwhile, Malcolm was crisscrossing the country, speaking at many of the nation's mosques. In October 1963, Malcolm came to the Bay Area to speak before an audience of 6,000 people on the campus of the University of California, Berkeley.
Mr. Moderator, students and faculty here at the University of California, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies. Recently, the state of California, the Supreme Court here, denied Negro inmates who had become converted to the religion of Islam while serving time in these penal institutions of this state, denied them the right to receive qualified Muslim religious instructors from the outside on the ground that the Muslims who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad are not an authentic religious group. At the same time, the state's esteemed body of educators here at the University of California barred me from speaking on this campus on the grounds that we do represent an authentic religious group.
He also visited Tahsin, who told me they continued to meet privately whenever Malcolm came to the Bay Area.
And he used to come and visit me in San Francisco. And I remember it well because I was in the consulate, but my mother was at home, and suddenly there was a knock on my door, not on the downstairs bell, and there were two dark faces dressed in dark charcoal, and she was scared a little bit, and she told them, yes, she doesn't know English well, but apparently they told her, his brother Tahsin there. She called me at the embassy and said, some people want to see you here. And it was Malcolm who came to see me. So we became friends and we talked a lot about Black Americans. I was interested in the movement. And at that time, very few Egyptians knew anything about Black Americans.
After Malcolm broke with the Nation of Islam in March 1964, he founded the Organization for Afro-American Unity, a secular Pan-Africanist group. He also made his obligatory pilgrimage to Mecca in Saudi Arabia, a trip Tahsin helped arrange. Malcolm set his sights on linking up with the leaders of the newly independent African and Middle Eastern nations. Foremost among them was Egypt's President Gamal Abdel Nasser. Tahsin helped broker the meeting.
So I suggested to people around Nasser that this leader should be exposed what Islam is. And Malcolm came to Egypt. I wasn't then in Egypt, and went and visited Mecca and Medina and returned back to Egypt. And I met him after his return from Mecca and Medina.
Malcolm met with Nasser for an hour and a half. He would later tell his eldest brother that when he met Nasser, he walked into his office and the Egyptian leader rose from behind his desk and embraced him warmly and, to his surprise, treated him like a peer.
From what I gathered from Malcolm, that it was a very positive meeting, and they came out of it satisfied.
Malcolm X spent 5 months overseas, visiting more than a dozen countries, meeting with political leaders across Africa and the Middle East. His goal, bringing the United States, which was being rocked by racial turmoil, to trial before the United Nations on charges of genocide. He emerged from his travels no longer as a black separatist leader, but a Pan-Africanist, and he started using his Muslim name, Elhaj Malik el-Shabazz as a devout follower of traditional Islam. But back in the United States, the Nation of Islam, plagued by high-level corruption, was splintering. Shortly before he broke with the movement, Malcolm began to receive death threats and public denunciations from leaders in the movement. On a barge on the Nile River in late July 1964, Tahsin Siddi spoke alone with Malcolm, who was deep in thought about what he would say when he returned to the U.S.
He was very pensive of the issue of not to go and declare any attacks on Elijah Muhammad's interpretation of Islam. And I told him that teaching for Islam will take a long time in a gradual way. And while the issue of color should be de-emphasized by showing the multicolor of Muslims, it should not be done in a shocking way.
During what would be their last meeting, Tahsin cautioned his friend to tread carefully.
I advised Malcolm not to go and say that publicly when he goes back to America, because this will be an attack on Elijah. It might split the movement, and many in it, in the leadership, will think that he's betraying them. And I even warned him that, don't do that, Malcolm, they might kill you. But don't challenge Elijah in his kingdom, his flock.
Those words turned out to be prophetic. 6 months later, Malcolm X was assassinated at New York's Audubon Ballroom. He was just 39. Tahsin Siddi was in Cairo when he heard the news about his friend.
I was shocked, but I knew that it was going to happen if Malcolm tried to undermine the leadership of Elijah.
Three members of the Nation of Islam were initially convicted of the murder, although two were subsequently exonerated after decades in prison. Tahsin would go on to serve in several diplomatic posts with the Egyptian government before becoming a public intellectual. 7 months after our interview, Tahsin Bashir died after a long illness. He was 76. In San Francisco, I'm Suni Khalid for Cross Currents.
That was Tahsin Bashir speaking with KELW's Suni Khalid. Historical consultant Paul Lee also contributed to the story. He's a visiting scholar at the Department of African American Studies at UC Berkeley. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. As we just heard, Malcolm X was hugely influential here in the Bay Area as a minister of the Nation of Islam, especially among black students. In the late 1960s, Abdul Rauf Nasir was a student at UC Berkeley. At the time, students were demanding change. His black teammates on the basketball team were threatening to strike when one of them was suspended, allegedly for his afro. On the academic side, students were demanding to be taught black studies. It was a time when the Nation of Islam was actively recruiting, and its message of black self-reliance resonated with Abdul Rauf. So he joined after a crucial moment for the nation, the assassination of Malcolm X. We hear an excerpt from his story, part of our series Becoming Muslim from the Spiritual Edge Project.
The assassination of Malcolm X was an unfortunate tragedy.
By the time Abdul Rauf got to Berkeley in 1967, Malcolm had been dead 2 years, but his presence was still huge.
I began to study Malcolm, and his approach was, of course, self-defense.
Abdul Rauf began to read Malcolm's writings and learn about his role in helping grow the nation alongside leader Elijah Muhammad.
He was energetic. He was brilliant. And he was full of energy to spread those teachings.
Abdul-Rauf was just one of many young people who were drawn to the nation during this period. Its message was simple and effective, that Christianity was the religion of the white man forced onto them by slavery, and that Islam was the original faith of their African ancestors they needed to return to. A message that was instrumental to converting generations of African Americans to Islam. At this point in his life, Abdul-Rauf was watching as friends were starting to join.
One sister who was a good friend of mine, and we used to, you know, do a lot of stuff together. She was active in student work, in the movements and what have you. And one day I go to her house, and she's got on this white dress. And actually, I was going there to do some of the illegal stuff we used to do together, you know. She said she no longer did that. So that really impressed me.
And one afternoon in 1969, he decided to go to his first nation meeting across the bay in San Francisco.
When I went there, I saw some of my other neighborhood friends. In fact, there was a guy who was a janitor at Berkeley High School, a couple athletes from other schools. They had converted.
The message was appealing to a wide range of folks.
Nation of Islam was a self-help organization, so they were saying that we had the responsibility to do these things for ourselves, that we're asking white people to do for us. This is what I've been reading in the paper, but now I'm hearing it live from one of their representatives. They're very, very effective speakers.
Abdul-Rauf was entranced and was primed and ready to join.
And so at the end of that meeting, they asked, who believes what you heard is the truth? And you stand up. And they said, if you want to get more information, follow that guy right there. So you follow the guy at the back, one of their representatives in the back, and then they give out these letters. They say, if you want to join your own and be yourself, then you write this letter. And it's a letter that says, I want to get a name. I want to give back the slave master's name.
He's given the name Abdul-Rauf Nasir, and he won't tell me his former name. He feels very strongly about what happened that day, the day he became a member of the Nation of Islam. He started coming to the meetings, learning the teachings, the prayers. His transition was smooth, but some things were hard to deal with.
One of the key things, and one of the things that was emphasized at the time, was not eating pork. My problem was when I would go home and my mother would cook, I'm not eating that. And then you shouldn't eat it. And I want to throw her pork out in her house. And so that's where the difficulty came in. Boy, you lost your mind. You're crazy. Blah, blah, blah. I raised you on that. Look, you was eating it yesterday. Now you're not eating what, you know.
A big part of being a member was being part of the independent economy. And that newspaper, he was selling that too now, helping the nation achieve incredible sales numbers.
They sold 1 million copies a week.
A week.
Because all the men were required to sell the paper. We bought farmland. We started importing fish, millions of pounds of fish, and we would take them door to door along with the bean pie.
The iconic black Muslim bean pies, still sold to this day outside mosques across the country. Years go by, Abdul graduates with a degree in social science, and in the coming years, he would witness the nation going through a huge transformation, one that would force him to make a critical decision about what he believed. You can hear about that choice and the rest of Abdul-Rauf's story at KALW.org and by subscribing to the Spiritual Edge podcast. And we're proud to say that story just won the Gold Ziyar Prize for excellence in the coverage of Muslim Americans. Congrats and thanks to the team, engineer Tariq Foda, editor Jeb Sharp, and executive producer Judy Silber. This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. May is Older Americans Month, and if you've been following, you've been hearing our series that profiles San Franciscans who are 80 and older. It's 80 over 80 San Francisco.
A lot of things have changed. A lot of things have not.
Old age is coming along, and I need to have the time to experience it.
Anne-Marie Israel is originally from France, but she lived in San Francisco since the 50s. She's familiar with tragedy and the strength that can come from self-reliance. She was interviewed by Anna Chodos, the director of the 80 Over 80 Project.
My name is Anne-Marie Israel, 93, just 93. I am an old finicky lady. I can be amusing if I wish to be. Most of the time, I speak too much of the thing I shouldn't speak about. I am the great-grandmother of 16 great-grandchildren, and they all love me. They all are very attentive to my needs, and they think of me as something that is a bit away from the norm, sometimes a bit strange, because of my background. I was not born here. I am French, basically. And I have been in San Francisco for a lot of years now, in the same place for the past 60 years. My husband was in real estate, and he passed away when he was 33. Actually, it was suicide. So I was left as a single mother with four daughters. I began with as a cleaning woman. I got a desk job, Fireman's Fund Insurance Company, after that for 14 years, after which I retired and administered the place where I lived, the six unit, which we bought in 63, and which I took care of all this time. With the pandemic, I used to go to the gym at the Jewish Center three times a day. Then I did some volunteer work. I volunteered at the Blood Center for 4 years. And after that, I worked at the St. Dominic's Church for the homeless, distributing food. All that is gone. So all my social activities are gone. I never had leisure to make friends, really, so that I am isolated. When you are alone and you can't go anywhere, if nobody wants to help you, you are stuck. In fact, I have a friend. She just passed away. She was 19 hours senseless in her home before somebody inquired. So, you know, it's if something happened to me today, nobody would know unless I call or anything like that. So it's nice to know there are some people who cares, but you cannot really count on something in advance. I mean, people will tell you, if you need anything, call me. But when you call them, they're not there. You know, so when you're alone, you're alone. Somehow, I never realized how important family love is until I needed it. Now they manage to do, like, one of my granddaughters sent me pound cakes, which I love. Another one, a farmer in Alaska, sent me honey. My daughter comes in every day to inquire, you know, and then, well, they say you love me, but you realize that there is something alive there, then they really mean it.
What are you looking forward to?
Dying. What else is there? There is no future when you are 93. Your present is present.
That was Anne-Marie Israel, interviewed for the 80 Over 80 San Francisco Project. The lead audio producer is Aussie Linas Goodman. Anna Chodos is the project director. And you can find more at klw.org.
Foi o que eu arranjei pra mim. Estavas roxa por trouxa pra fazer cartaz. Na tua lista de conquista tem bobo a mais.
Today's Cross Currents team includes Angela Johnston, Kristen McCandless, DeAndre Ball, Ryan Housel, Gabe Graben, Victor Tentz, Lisa Morehouse, Shia Levitt, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trevney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba. Pela mulher que não me quer.